and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the largest rally yet for a presidential candidate that took place in Madison, Wisconsin on Wednesday night, where up to 12,000 people jammed the Veterans Memorial Coliseum to hear Senator Bernie Sanders call for a political revolution, declaring the big money interests, Wall Street, corporate America, all of these guys have so much power that no president can defeat them unless there is an organized grassroots movement making them an offer they can't refuse. The mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, Paul Soglin, joins us to discuss this breakout event and whether the lessons from the defeats of Senator Eugene McCarthy and George McGovern apply to Bernie Sanders' campaign. Then we'll examine the June jobs report with Elise Gould, a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, that shows a modest increase in jobs growth with a 7-year low in unemployment in an economy where wages have not grown for working Americans since the late 1970s, with many earning less today than they did back then. We'll also discuss the likelihood that this report will not give the Fed Chair Janet Yellen the decisive evidence she needs to see in the job market to raise interest rates. Then finally, we will assess the largest settlement to be paid by a single company in U.S. history, the $18.7 billion BP has agreed with the Justice Department to pay to resolve years of litigation over BP's 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Scott Eustace, a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist with the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans, joins us to discuss details of the settlement and whether it measures up to the damage done by the worst environmental disaster in U.S. history. And joining us now is Paul Soglin, the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin, who was originally elected to Madison City Council in 1968 while a graduate student. He was also very active in that city's anti-war protests, and his activities are chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. Paul Soglin served 3 terms as the city's mayor starting in 1973 and another 3 terms in the 1990s, and previously he taught at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Soglin.
It's good to be back with you. It's been a while,
but you've had quite a big night last night at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum. Bernie Sanders drew a huge crowd. There are some conflicting numbers. They could be as high as 13,000. What's your count?
My guess is minimum 10,000, and it's probably over 12, considering that there were a few empty seats at the back of the floor, but virtually everything in the Coliseum was filled as well as all the seats on the floor. It was not just the size of the crowd, it was the enthusiasm, and it was the relationship between Bernie Sanders, who I'm told was a bit nervous before giving the speech, given the size of the crowd. But he was really on, and the working of the crowd and the senator together made it one of the most exciting political events I've been to in my life.
And Senator Sanders' call for a political revolution, declaring the big money interests, Wall Street, corporate America, all of these guys have so much power that no president can defeat them unless there is an organized grassroots movement making them an offer they can't refuse. I take it that line went down pretty well.
That line went down, as did the theme that covered one simple notion, and unfortunately it is revolutionary. And that theme was that the people who do the labor, who do the work, should be the beneficiary of their efforts. It was that simple.
But why call that revolutionary? You're being ironic?
Well, you know, from a logical standpoint, from a fairness standpoint, from the basis of the founding of this country, the notion that those who create the wealth ought to fairly share in the wealth is not revolutionary in this society. And yet, because of the times we live in, because of the $1 billion that that the Koch brothers and their friends are going to put into this next election because of the enormous record disparity in income and all the stuff that we know. Yes, it is a revolutionary idea in our lifetime.
But arguably, Paul Soglin, the Koch brothers, who of course refer to themselves as job creators, didn't create the wealth alone, although they did certainly do a lot on Wall Street. Most of their wealth actually comes from Wall Street speculation. But nevertheless, it's not that the plutocrats in this country created the wealth on their own. They were helped enormously by the people who worked for them, surely.
Well, that is the labor, and that is the issue of fairness that we need to address in this nation. And we really have to stop the exploitation that's occurring in so many of our in the states and in so many workplaces in the U.S., whether we're talking about health insurance, whether we're talking about sick leave, whether we're talking about leave at the time of the birth of a baby, whether we're talking about fairly paying people on an hourly basis, whether it's the tomato harvesters in Florida or those working in factories in California. Let me just make one point. I don't want to dwell on the numbers. It's a little difficult, but it's even more challenging when we're on the radio without anything to look at. But the bottom line is this. The so-called Walker and Koch brothers success story here in Wisconsin is the big lie. It is the lie of the decade, and hopefully it'll be exposed between our own Governor Walker's campaign as well as the success of Senator Sanders' campaign. And the point to reduce it to its essence is this. Here in Madison, in the Madison area, where we try and develop our economy very differently than the governor does in the rest of the state, we are the ones who are principally responsible for what economic success Wisconsin has had in recent years. We are now, our region has gone from being 12% of the state's economic output to 17% of the state's economic output. And that is a significant increase. And the point is, we did it not following the idiocy of the way the governor proposes, but we've done it in alignment with the concepts of Senator Sanders and other progressives, which is you invest in human capacity, you invest in infrastructure, and you make a commitment to grow a robust economy for the 99%, not just the 1%.
But your governor, who sort of lives, I think, in occupied territory, given that most of the citizens of Madison, and I've been there a few times, and every bumper sticker says, recall Walker. So you get the feeling that he's living in occupied territory. But nevertheless, in his campaign so far, he's teased today that he'll be announcing soon. But so far, he was asked a question about foreign policy in which he said that his hero, of course, is Ronald Reagan. And Ronald Reagan's greatest foreign policy moment was when he stood up to the employees of PATCO, the Air Traffic Controllers
right.
Union. And then he went on to say that he stood and faced 100,000 of his own citizens. How could that be a badge of honor to stare down 100,000 of your own citizens that are angry with you because you have lowered their standard of living? How can you be proud and run as President of the United States on a ticket that your greatest claim to fame is that you diminish the standard of living of your fellow Americans?
Well, if you're trying to establish an oligarchy, that's pretty consistent. But on the other hand, when you've got somebody like Bernie Sanders, there's at least some hope that we've got national leadership that realizes that if workers are paid fairly, if workers are compensated and appreciated, that you not only help the economic and well-being of that particular family, but all of us do better. There's a very simple proposition which is well established. If the family of the kid sitting next to your child in the classroom does better, your child will do better. And if you look at the essence of what Senator Sanders, what Bernie said last night, the point is we can either divide this country and further the economic inequality and not address these enormous disparity gaps in gender, in race, in terms of ethnic background, in terms of bias that takes place in our society, covering, unfortunately, a whole gamut of folks in our population. Or we can appreciate fair compensation for fair work, expand the workforce. And that's really critical, expand the workforce, because real unemployment in this country is about 11%. And not only do those households do better, but we all do better. Now, some of the WAGs said, how are you going to pay for all of this? How are you going to pay for public education? How are you going to pay for university education so students today aren't burdened with these enormous loans when they graduate? And Senator Sanders has got it right. You grow the economy, and you've solved half the problem, because with all these folks working, they will be paying in their fair share of the taxes. And the other half of it is, why don't we start getting some of the 1% to start paying taxes like the rest of us? That's not a novel idea.
Well, the jobs report just came out for June, and in terms of job creation, Wisconsin ranked 35th in the nation in 2011, 36th in 2012, 38th in 2013, and again 38th in 2014. So the Walker doesn't have much to crow about, does he?
He doesn't have much to crow about, and the tragic part from my standpoint as the mayor of Madison is our good efforts make him look even better, as miserable as his efforts are. Madison as a percentage of the state is responsible for 74% of the private sector job growth since 2004. Over the last decade, even though our metro area is about 14% of the state, we've created 74% of the jobs, obviously working with a very different economic philosophy as Scott Walker, and one that's much aligned with Bernie Sanders.
So Thursday, this is an extraordinary coincidence, the very day after Bernie Sanders' extraordinary rally in Wisconsin, the biggest political rally so far in this presidential campaign by far. I think Hillary had about 5,000 people at her announcement, and the Republicans haven't gotten anywhere even near that figure. I think Jeb Bush may have had 3,000.
Well, there's one candidate who did have over 10,000 when the entire university where he spoke was required to attend. So,
and who was that?
that
was Ted Cruz, wasn't it? Ted Cruz at the
yes.
Liberty University.
Yes.
Jerry Falwell's place, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, glad you corrected me, but it hardly measures up to Bernie Sanders, obviously.
I get a little concerned when I look at some of the more totalitarian nations in the world where students and workers are required to show up at the leaders' political rallies.
Right.
A little disconcerting.
Yes, well, we start calling Ted Cruz the dear leader. But Thursday, the very day after Bernie Sanders' rally, President Obama shows up in Wisconsin, where Governor Walker has to greet him at the airport. And the president's in Wisconsin to make a speech about his new overtime policy at the University of Wisconsin campus, the very campus that Governor Walker is eviscerating in terms of arbitrarily cutting their budget. My understanding is the University of Wisconsin is one of the most successful universities in the country and is a job creator and a money creator, if you will. So why is he cutting it? It's been a huge magnet to your state.
Okay, so we've got the University of Wisconsin system. The flagship university is here in Madison, and there are state campuses in La Crosse and Stevens Point and Green Bay, Milwaukee, and another half a dozen cities. And it is, as you've said, one of the stellar state university, public university systems in the U.S., in terms of research, in terms of educating the young people of the state, in terms of generating billions and billions of dollars. So why would he do this? Well, it's because of the Koch brothers program. It's really rather simple, and it's why we're seeing the attack on education at all levels. It's got nothing to do with education. It has nothing to do with students. It has a lot to do with the reality that unions are seen as the enemy, because unions generally are democratic, support workers' rights, and stand for so many things that the Koch brothers hate. And which are the very worst of the unions? They are the public unions. And which are the worst of the public unions? They are the unions of educators. And in fact, it doesn't have to be a union. It has to deal with anybody who's involved in education. What we have to do is economically destroy these people so that we reduce their political influence. That is why we've got education, so-called education reform going on in this country, and this is just one more part of it.
But that is a medieval attitude, isn't it? You're creating an uneducated permanent underclass.
Ian, welcome to Wisconsin.
Well, not Wisconsin, Scott Walker's Wisconsin.
And this is why they're committed to spending all that money on his election as president, so that what they've done to this great progressive state, you know, this is where child labor laws originated. This is where workers' compensation originated. This is where public employee unions were born. This is the home of the La Follettes. This was a strong fortress in the war on slavery and the Underground Railroad. And if Scott Walker can do it here, he can do it there, he can do it in California, and that's what the Koch brothers want. The simple thing I don't understand is, don't they, the Koch brothers and Scott Walker, understand that one day, if they destroy the middle class, they are going to kill off the serfs and the peasants that are going to be serving them, and there'll be nobody left to do the work.
So they'll be on the veranda of the antebellum mansion, sipping mint juleps with African-American servants in white pressed uniforms, and the rest of us will be toiling in the lower 40. So it's a plantation mentality, I take
it. It is a plantation mentality, and they don't even have the wisdom of those slave owners to understand that you can't kill off your workforce.
Well, let's turn in the last few minutes, Paul Soglin, to the broader context of the Bernie Sanders race. First of all, he's the longest-serving independent in the history of American politics. He caucuses with the Democrats. He's running as an independent, but he wants to be in the Democratic debates. So he is trying to achieve that. And most of the punditry tells us that it's a fool's errand, that a liberal will never get elected president, let alone a socialist. And that history bears that out with the examples of Eugene McCarthy and George McGovern. So what do you say to that?
Well, I've been listening to speeches and engaged in politics for a while now. I can remember in 1956 being at the radio with my parents listening to the results of the second Eisenhower-Stevenson race. And from that point on, obviously carefully following the Kennedy-Nixon race in 1960 and everything that's gone on since. Last night, I was amazed at the relationship between Bernie Sanders and the audience, but I was also amazed at the fact as to how excited I was at the age of 70, having gone through so many horrendous defeats, knowing what happened in that most tragic year of 1968, the battering that George McGovern took in 1972, the stealing of Bush 2's win over Al Gore, and the horrid consequences that gave us, not just for the following 8 years, but up until this date. And I am absolutely convinced that Bernie Sanders can win this, that he can not only unite Democrats, but do something so special, which is to bring in working class, middle class Republicans who have got to stop voting against their own self-interest and put together a working coalition that is going to change the dynamics of this country as FDR did in 1932. And these are not old, tired ideas. They are ones that have been proven to work in terms of how to build a robust economy for everyone, for the person making $12 an hour who should be making $18, for the person making $7 an hour who should be making $15, for the couple that between the two of them are working 4 and 5 part-time jobs and still not able to live reasonably with and raising their families.
So do you think, though, that this rally last night in Madison with 12,000 people and all of that enthusiasm that was visible there and the energy and the purpose, if it continues and snowballs, and as you mentioned, Senator Sanders doesn't, you know, when I did a rally for him out here in Los Angeles a while back in the end of March, he said, you know, it's not a question of left and right in this country anymore. He said, I don't believe in that anymore. Everything that I'm talking about is something that 99% of the people understand, but they only understand it if they hear it, and they don't hear it because of the press. Do you think the press is going to change its attitude and allow a broader discussion about the issues that Senator Sanders is introducing?
Bernie Sanders is going to end up embarrassing a lot of people. And while it's not going to be malicious on his part, though the press that fails to cover this campaign and cover the issues, the real economic issues, the real issues of fairness, they're going to have some explaining to do unless they come around. I mean, we know, and I don't know if you've followed this recent book that just came out, and I think the gentleman's from Los Angeles, Dog Whistle Politics.
Oh, I just interviewed Ian Haney Lopez the other day.
Okay.
Last Sunday, yeah.
All right, great. So there's going to be a real effort to play dog whistle politics with Bernie Sanders. The Republicans are going to do it. Certainly Fox News is going to do it. Some others may do it. And there might even be some Democrats who engage in that kind of chicanery. The real test of our time, the real test for Bernie Sanders' campaign is, can he reach the disenfranchised, angry Americans who have been screwed over by the Koch brothers, and get a clear picture to them as to who is working for them and who is not working for them? I mean, for that working family that's toiling, that the adults in the household barely get to see each other. They don't get the time with their children. Their children are in adequate schools. To get them to understand that the people killing public education, the people who are killing transportation, so they've got long, sweaty commutes to get to work. It's the Koch brothers. It's the Governor Walkers of this country. And that it's such a simple proposition to create new equity and fairness.
Well, Paul Soglin, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's always been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Paul Soglin, who's the mayor of Madison, Wisconsin. He was originally elected to Madison City Council in 1968 while a graduate student. He also was very active in the city's anti-war protest, and his activities are chronicled in David Moranis' best-selling book, They Marched Into Sunlight. Paul Soglin served three terms as the city's mayor, starting in 1973 and another three terms in the 1990s, and previously taught at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back examining the June jobs report. What have we done? How did we get so far from the sun? Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Elise Gould, who's a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, where she works on wages, employment, poverty, and health insurance. And she's the co-author of The State of Working America, 12th edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elise Gould.
Thank you so much for having me.
And the Labor Department has come out with its job support, where in June there was 223,000 jobs added and the unemployment rate fell to 5.3%, which is a seven-year low. This is being celebrated certainly at the White House, but this is a modest jump in jobs, but no growth in wages.
That's correct. It is a very modest jump in jobs. I was hoping for much higher, and in fact, last month we saw it was originally 280,000 jobs, and that got revised downward, as did the month before. So those both looked 60,000 jobs weaker. So it is a much weaker picture this month and even in the last 3 months than we had previously.
So this is not likely then to alter the Fed chair, Janet Yellen's. She said previously that she's waiting for decisive evidence of labor market recovery before she raises interest rates.
That's right. We saw year-over-year average nominal earnings, hourly nominal earnings, was just 2% lower than we've seen actually in the last couple of months. And I think that that is a clear sign, along with many other indicators, that the Fed should keep their foot off the brakes, don't do anything, don't raise interest rates. Let's let the economy grow stronger.
But isn't the, if you really sort of dig into the jobs profile, if you will, for want of a better description, a lot of the jobs, a lot of people actually are stuck in part-time jobs, sometimes several part-time jobs. And apparently there's, you know, something, what, about 6.5 million people we're talking about here?
Right. There are many people that are still working part-time jobs, that is, people that would like full-time employment that are working part-time. The underemployment rate overall, so people who not only would like to be working full-time, people who are discouraged and have stopped looking so actively, there are a lot of those people. The 5.3 unemployment rate that you mentioned, which is absolutely correct, I think it misstates the weakness of the economy. And it fell. It fell from 5.5% down to 5.3% in June. But that fall is almost entirely driven by people leaving the labor force. So people who have given up looking, you see the drop in the unemployment level is not because there's been lots of people getting more jobs. It's more because people have left the labor force because of weak job opportunities.
So they just sort of evaporate into a sort of statistical void. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's not a statistical void. We actually count them. We have a measure at the Economic Policy Institute called missing workers. These are potential workers who would be actively looking for jobs, or they would be working if job opportunities were stronger. And we found this month that they went up to over 3 million. So these are over 3 million people that aren't actively looking. They may have looked for a job in the last year, but not in the last 4 weeks. You have to look in the last 4 weeks to be officially counted as unemployed, according to the U3 official unemployment measure. And so they have left the labor force, or maybe they're young people who have never entered the labor force. And I believe that as job opportunities become stronger, and I'm hoping that they will become stronger in coming months, that we will see them returning to the labor force.
And Senator Bernie Sanders, of course, is doing extremely well in the Democratic presidential primaries. He had a record turnout in Madison, Wisconsin on Wednesday night. And what he's been saying on the stump is that American workers simply, their wages have been flat since the 1970s. If anything, in many cases, they've gone down. Is that the real broader picture here?
Yes, absolutely. We think about the Great Recession. We think about what's happening to wages over the last 5 years or the last 7 years, the last decade and a half since about 2002. But really, you go back to 1979 and you see that for the vast majority of workers, they've seen very sluggish, very slow wage growth, and for some, very little wage growth at all.
And how has whatever, the government, the establishment, whatever, how they've gotten away with it? Why is it? I mean, people must know it in their bones, but it's not discussed in the media.
Right. I mean, one of the things that's important to note is, well, what does that mean? How do we compare that? What's our benchmark to compare that to? And one of the things you want to look at is, well, what was the potential? So one of the things that we look at the Economic Policy Institute, we compare this pay productivity gap. So productivity is the potential for the increases in wages and salaries and benefits, because workers are producing more output per hour worked. And so that gives you that potential, and you see that that has been climbing. So we know that the economy has been growing, and workers have gotten more productive. They've become more educated than ever before, and yet their wages have been very dismal. And I think a lot of that has to do with the loss of worker bargaining power to be able to bid up their wages, to be able to get a bigger slice of that pie, and that has to do in part to the decline in unionization in this country.
Well, I've seen graphs where it's been very clear that productivity and household income have tracked parallel for many decades, and then in the late 1970s, the line diverges, where productivity goes way up for capital and the household income is in a steady decline. So that's the picture that I recall. And so is that what you're saying?
Yes. I'm specifically talking about wages or compensation and not income. So thinking about what workers are getting is a clear measure. But you're absolutely right. When you see that disconnect, when you see that rise in wage inequality, it allows for that increasing returns to capital, increasing returns to those at the very top. And that concentration of wages at the top has led to concentration in income, concentration in wealth, concentration in political power.
And you attribute that to the weakening of labor unions, but there has to be broader factors. My understanding is that one of the real changes, and of course the change happened largely under, at least it began with President Reagan, that one of the ways that we've disguised the lack of income growth in this country is by making credit available. which certainly happened under Chairman Greenspan of the Fed, with the cheap credit available. Obviously, they, you know, borrow at, what, 2% from the banks and charge the consumers 20-plus percent. But the long and the short of it is that the artificial means by which people have been given the illusion that their standard of living is, they've maintained a standard of living, not that their wages have gone up, they've been flat or they've gone down, but they've had to turn to credit to maintain their standard of living?
That's a great question. I have to say I don't know as much about that, but it's certainly true that before the housing bubble burst, that many people were using that as a way to be able to smooth out their consumption if they lost a job, be able to have access to that money, and people no longer have access to those kinds of backing anymore because of the drop in housing prices.
Well, what we certainly know is that savings have all but evaporated for the average American since the beginning of the 80s.
Right. It's certainly true that the ability for people to make ends meet and a little more, be able to save or be able to pay off their student loans, that has become increasingly difficult because living standards, wages primarily, have simply not kept up.
So do you think that President Obama is doing us a favor by, you know, cheering these numbers?
I haven't seen him directly cheering these numbers. I think one thing that he has done this week that has been extremely positive when you think about living standards and people and their wages is these overtime protections that he is expanding to give overtime protections to not just those that have the very lowest wages, but those who have moderate wages that have been denied overtime protections for years and years in this country. So that is something that I believe he has done this week that is going to be a huge boost to millions of Americans and their ability to make ends meet.
Yeah, perhaps what I'm reacting to is I saw a lead story at the Huffington Post, a picture of a smiling Obama, and the headline being that unemployment has fallen to a 7-year low. That may not necessarily be that he's made any particular statements about it today. I haven't heard.
I'm sorry, I'm not aware.
Yeah, well, neither have I. So perhaps I'm mischaracterizing Obama's cheering these numbers. But at the same time, I don't think that anybody's much, and certainly in the political realm, except for Bernie Sanders, is having the kind of conversation that we're having, surely.
Right, right. I mean, I think increasingly so, people are seeing that these wage numbers, these low growth numbers cannot be ignored. I think the Fed is making the right decision here, and I hope that they continue to. And so I think that they have attention to what is going on. And I think that as the political season moves on, I think more and more people will be talking about it.
So why is it then that when you have interest rates at all-time record lows, has there not been an investment in infrastructure? Everybody agrees that infrastructure in this country, critical infrastructure, is crumbling to a dangerous degree. And we saw, you know, the recent Amtrak derailing. It became very apparent there. It just seems an extraordinarily missed opportunity. What's your sense of why this is happening? Is it to do with political gridlock?
Yes. I mean, I think we've decided as a country, or Congress has decided, that austerity is the way of the future. And so we have abandoned all fiscal policy to generate jobs growth to get this economy moving on a faster track.
And what's behind that, though? Is it, if you have austerity, which is clearly, if you look at the picture in Europe, particularly with Greece, you know that it's a complete disaster. It doesn't stimulate the economy. It doesn't do what President Kennedy said, you know, a rising tide raises all boats. We know that the only boats that are being raised are for the 1%. And the 99% are bailing out, you know, as their boat sinks.
Right. I mean, there's the direct effect of public sector jobs. In June, public sector job growth was zero, you know, just zero. We saw that's a direct result of austerity policy. Public sector jobs are still nearly down 500,000 from where they were before the recession began. And if you take into account population growth, they're down about 1.8 million public sector jobs. And that shortfall in public sector jobs in turn removes the multiplier effect on private sector demand, which then snowballs into an even slower recovery. So it's damaging on so many levels.
Well, Governor Walker of Wisconsin is literally running on the platform that he is proud of the fact that he downsized. It's not that he got rid of public sector jobs in Wisconsin. he downsized their ability to have a living wage and to have collective bargaining. And now we have a Supreme Court decision. The Supreme Court's just taken up a case here in California of a conservative school teacher from Orange County who's been picked up by a right-wing advocacy group in Washington, and it's gotten to the Supreme Court, that basically could eliminate the ability of public sector unions to become viable, because they'll take away the requirement for members to pay union dues.
Right. The legislation to weaken public sector unions, to weaken unions generally, is definitely a negative move in this country. Unions historically have not only lifted the wages of union members, but also non-union workers who are working in similar sectors, similar industries in the economy, and they have done a great deal to lift with living standards. And so by removing those protections, by removing the ability for unions to be strong and bargain for better wages and benefits, workers will be hurt.
And the people who are funding and prosecuting this movement, that Governor Scott Walker is there carrying the water for them, are, of course, among the richest Americans, the Koch brothers, who between them have something like $100 billion in wealth. It's an extraordinary picture, isn't it? Do you think that two uber-wealthy people have managed to get their political surrogates to be so successful in reducing the standard of living of so many of their fellow Americans?
Yes, it is.
Well, on that note, Elise Gould, I wish you a happy 4th of July holiday, and hopefully we'll talk again.
Yes, you as well. Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Elise Gould, who's a senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute, where she works on wages, employment, poverty, and health insurance issues. She's the co-author of The State of Working America, its 12th edition. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back assessing the largest settlement to be paid by a single company in U.S. history.
Bring me my boots and shoes. You can hang back or fight your best on the front line. Sing a little bit of these working band blues. Well, I'm sailing on back, ready for the long haul, tossed by the winds and the seas. I'll drag them all down.
Now the deep water horizon descends down to death's door, and at the bird's foot they've lost all hope. 'Cause all is drifting for miles and miles, poisoning the Gulf of Mexico.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Scott Eustace, who's a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Eustace.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And BP have reached a $18.7 billion settlement with the U.S. Department of Justice following the 2010 Gulf of Mexico oil spill. And this, I suppose, they have forked out some money so far. Does this money that they've agreed to pay, is that any of their previous expenditures are included in this, or is this a separate award?
This is a separate settlement of the remaining natural resource damages. We did, across the Gulf Coast, see an early agreement of $1 billion down payment. And this settlement, if it moves forward to the final stages, would resolve the Oil Pollution Act natural resource damages for a total of $8.1 billion. That's $8.1 billion to be devoted to natural resource projects to explicitly repair the damages of BP across the five Gulf states, and mostly centered in the state of Louisiana, where the impacts were the highest, but also some to the marine environment as well.
Right, but the $1 billion down payment, is that subtracted from the $8?
No, that is part of the $8.1 billion.
That's part of it. So in other words, they owe another $7?
Yes.
I see. So where does the $18.7 billion come? What happens to the other $10 billion.
Right. The other 10 are less restricted. Some goes $5.5 billion are due to the United States Clean Water Act civil penalties. BP had already settled its criminal plea penalties. That was another $5 billion that's not a part of this 18.7. But the civil penalties amounted to $5.5 billion. The maximum that United States federal prosecutors could have pursued was on the order of $13 or $14 billion, but it, you know, we, the money now is worth more than money later, and I think that our government, state, and federal moved forward with a settlement and took less money to get a deal worked out. Those monies, the civil penalties, are subject to the Restore Act in the United States, in which some monies go toward oil response for future disasters, and then other monies, 80%, will return to the Gulf Coast for large-scale ecosystem restoration above and beyond the immediate damages of BP. So we're looking at large-scale restoration of rivers into their estuaries that then feed the ecosystem of the Gulf of Mexico. And then there's a remainder around $4.9 billion for state economic losses. So we're hoping that these monies for large-scale natural resource restoration projects can be leveraged. Those projects are economic development in and of themselves, and we're hoping that the states and our federal government will leverage those monies that are committed to natural resource restoration with the additional monies that are more unrestricted, so that we see most of this $18.7 billion going toward economic development that restores our environment.
And so when the United States Attorney General Loretta Lynch, in announcing this settlement of $18.7 billion that BP's agreed to pay, she points out, of course, that it's the largest settlement paid by a single company in U.S. history. But the blowout in the Gulf, the Deepwater Horizon blowout in the Gulf, was the greatest ecological disaster in U.S. history, if not even in global history, right?
Indeed, yes. And we're still seeing the damages wash up on our shore. There is a large area of the Gulf bottom that still has different oil materials rolling around and causing damages that are unknown. Some monies have been allocated to study these ongoing impacts. You know, we still have what's called an unusual mortality event of the bottlenose dolphin across the Gulf Coast, where we're seeing an unusual amount of dolphins wash up on our shores. And so we're continuing to see these damages from an event 5 years ago, and we're continuing to study them. So there are some monies, $500 million, dedicated to measuring the ongoing impact, and as part of the settlement, I think it's above $200 million for any unforeseen damages. I think we, as an environmental organization, want to see, as part of the final settlement, a strong reopener clause in case that amount of money is insufficient to cover repairing unforeseen damages. We don't have a lot to compare this too. So we are in a little bit of uncharted waters with these settlements. But we know that in the wake of the Valdez decision, we had an agreement of how much Exxon needed to pay to restore the ecosystem of Prince William Sound. And then after that agreement was made, the sardine fishery collapsed, and those damages did not appear on Exxon's balance sheet. So what we want is a good reopener clause in case an essential fishery like the Gulf Menhaden fishery shows some impacts down the line, because the damages from the oil spill are still very present, and then the ecosystem effects will take decades to be revealed.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Eustace, who's a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. So, but this reopening clause, since this is a settlement, the implication is this is a final settlement. Is there a back door? Is the door still open, or at least a little bit ajar?
Well, as I said, there's monies to study the ongoing impacts, and I think if we see a large impact that we don't foresee immediately, and that would be something like the Gulf Menhaden fishery on a serious downturn, or something. We've seen some recovery. We've seen some species like the red snapper not had the greatest recruitment in the eastern Gulf of Mexico after BP's disaster. But I think that our governments are satisfied with the amount of money taken to repair those damages. But we know that, ecosystem effects take decades to show themselves sometimes. And so we'd like a clause in the final settlement in case we do see a large-scale problem that we aren't looking at just yet, because the damages are ongoing. But this settlement to take the money now rather than spend years in court is a really important landmark for moving forward with sustainable development in the Gulf Coast. And we really need our state leaders on the Gulf Coast to uphold the spirit of the Restore Act and commit to spending these funds on good science-based ecosystem restoration projects. The focus should be on both short and long-term solutions for restoring both the coastal and the marine environments, as well as creating resilience in our coastal communities in the face of climate change and sea level rise.
So, Scott Eustace, does the anywhere in these settlements guarantee or at least move in some direction towards preventing another kind of incident like this blowout in the Gulf? Because remember, it was the blowout preventer that failed to operate, and there's a lot of subsequent investigations into why and who was at fault for it, whether it was the manufacturer, or whether it was the cement that was improperly poured, whether Halliburton was at fault. There was also a lot of reporting done on the extent to which BP was at fault from its management level, because they were pushing the envelope too hard and they were disregarding people on the actual rig itself, their warnings. So, but at the end of the day, it was all about this blowout preventer, which is supposed to stop these things from happening. It didn't work. So is there anything definitive about what's happening with the quality of blowout preventers so that they work in the future?
That is not part of this settlement. That I think we at Gulf Restoration Network, we remain very concerned about the safety of oil workers and the safety of the oil fields and its damages to the environment. We still see a lot of the systemic problems offshore Louisiana and Texas. We have a very old oil field developments. There's a lot of rust buckets out there that routinely leak, and we don't see the response that's needed. We don't see the penalties against companies to incentivize the companies to maintain their infrastructure in the Gulf. After the BP disaster, where we came very, very aware of the dangers of deep water drilling, President Obama had an oil spill commission that issued a lot of recommendations on improvements to safety and environmental practices. A lot of those recommendations have not been fulfilled, and we remain deeply concerned about that as the United States opens up more of its coast, on the East Coast, as well as the state of Florida, perhaps, to deep water drilling. We feel we're not ready. We haven't fully absorbed the safety recommendations. The industry has taken it upon itself to form a group to make a better blowout preventer, and that's essentially where we are. That's where we've moved. We have another gadget, but we still feel that the response technologies are still lagging behind, and we still lag behind on monitoring and enforcement of the existing infrastructure.
So this money, of course, as you made clear, Scott Eustace, it doesn't really undo the damage that 200 million gallons of crude oil did to the Gulf. And I take it it certainly doesn't undo or bring about any restitution for the 11 crewmen that lost their lives on the Deepwater Horizon rig. They were all, settlements were made with them earlier, weren't there? I mean, I recall at the time they were holding a lot of the survivors and basically getting them to sign waivers. So I'm wondering, what do you know about that?
Well, those have been separate cases. Forgive me if I don't get all of it right. But yes, there are so many damages and aspects and facets of this disaster. There have been multiple, there are many, many cases. The 11 men who were quickly killed from the actual disaster itself had some settlement during the settlement of the criminal penalties that BP pled to. I think some of those families are still in different types of litigation with BP. And although this settlement settles some of the county or parish level claims, the smaller local government claims, some of those smaller local governments are still going to be in court with BP. And then there are the commercial fishermen and business. There are a number of different commercial litigations against BP, and some of those have been settled. Some of those are ongoing. BP has tried to weasel out of the settlement process that had previously agreed to with those. But this agreement will enable the state governments and the federal government to move forward with the restoration program that's being developed across the Gulf states 5 years later. So,
well, just in the last minute, though, Scott, I've seen endless amounts of commercials on television made and paid for by BP, showing fishermen and the shrimp catch and a nice sort of mum and apple pie woman walking along the beach saying how everything is wonderful. They spent a lot of money telling us that they've made good.
Indeed.
What's your sense in closing?
Well, no, we will continue to see the ecosystem impacts of BP's disaster for decades. And the hope is that this settlement will get a jump start on repairing those damages as well as studying those damages as they unfurl over the decades. It's also an opportunity for our governments along the coast to engage in sustainable economic development. But many, many of these ecological issues, of these issues of compensation to commercial fishermen, will remain open for, I think experience tells us with Exxon Valdez, some of these litigation questions will remain open for decades.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Scott Eustace.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Scott Eustace, who's a water policy analyst and coastal wetland specialist at the Gulf Restoration Network in New Orleans. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.